sand to get a purchase, I was putting forth a still greater effort upon a third shaft. Shall I say it aloud, or be silent? Then a pathetic moan came from the depth of the dune. A voice was saying to me, "Aeneas, you're tearing me. I am buried here. Don't hurt me. Don't dishonour your guiltless hands. I am a Trojan, no foreigner. That blood is drawn not from the wood. Get away from this cruel land, from these hard-fisted shores. I am Polydorus. The spears that nailed me down here have sprouted an iron crop above me, a thicket of javelin wood." Then an acute conflict appalled my mind. I stood there, dazed. My hair was on end and my voice stuck in my throat. This Polydorus had been unluckily sent by Priam, with store of gold, in secret, to lodge with the Thracian king, at a time when Priam began to have doubts about the resistance of Troy, perceiving how the blockade of the city was tightening. That king, when the Trojan fortunes ebbed and our power was crushed, went over to Agamemnon, tagged onto the winning side, breaking all laws of good faith. He murdered Polydorus and seized the gold. What lengths is the heart of man driven to by this cursed craving for gold? When I got over my panic, I referred the supernatural affair to our chosen counsellors, my father foremost, and asked them to give their views upon it. They were unanimous for leaving this guilty land where guest laws had been thus outraged, and setting sail again. So we hold a funeral service for Polydorus. We pile up earth on the dune, make an altar for the departed spirit, drape it with mourning bands and melancholy cypress. Our women stand round it, hair unbound as the rites require. Vessels foaming with fresh milk and bowls of victims' blood we ceremonially offer. We lay the ghost in its tomb, and call aloud on the spirit, a last hail and farewell. As soon as we dared launch forth, the winds granting a calm sea, a gently rustling breeze inviting the voyage, my comrades swarmed on the beach and warped our ships down into the water. We glide out of the roadstead. Cities and land grow distant. There is a holy island, sea-girt, in the good graces of the Nereid's mother and of Aegean Neptune. A floating island, it used to rove the archipelago, till Apollo moored it for men's use to Mykonos and Gyarus. Stationary now, no more at the beck and call of the winds. Hither I came, that peacefulest place, how securely it havened us weary folk. Disembarking, we worshipped Apollo's city. King Aeneas, who held both temporal and spiritual power there, came to meet us, wearing the sacred laurels and chaplet of Phoebus. He recognized Anchises as an old friend. Host and guests clasped hands. Then we went into the temple. I worshipped the god's dwelling of antique stone, and besought him, "Grant us a walled home of our own, a place for tired men, a future, and a continuing city. Ensure for us few, left by the Greeks and relentless Achilles, a second Troy. Who guides us? Where do you bid us go? Where shall we settle? Give us a sign, O Lord, and inspire our minds with your wisdom." The words were hardly out when a sudden tremor visibly quaked the god's house and his laurel. The mountains shook all over. The doors of the shrine flew open, and the sacred cauldron boomed. We prostrated ourselves on the earth. An utterance came to our ears. "O long-enduring Trojans, the land which first produced the stock from which you come, that same will take you back to her abundant breast. Seek out, then, your first mother. Here shall your house hold sway over earth from shore to shore. You and your children's children and the generations after them." Phoebus had spoken. A great babble of joy broke out. Everyone was asking, "Where is that promised land the God bids us return to out of our wanderings?" Then my father, pondering our people's traditions, said, "Give ear, O chieftains, and understand where your hopes are centered. There is a sea-girt island called Crete, Jupiter's birthplace. Here a Mount Ida stands. Here was our race cradled. 100 inhabited cities that prosperous kingdom owns. Thence, if I recollect the story aright, did Teucer, our famous ancestor, migrate once to the Troad, choosing a place for a kingdom. This was before Ilium and Troy's towers had been built. Men lived in the valley bottoms. From Crete are derived the Great Mother, the patron of Cybele, the symbols of the Corybantes, the grove of Ida, the hush of the faithful which belonged to Cybele's cult, and the lions yoked for her chariot. Come then, and let us follow where the gods' guidance leads. Let us appease the weather and sail for the land of Crete. It is not far away. If Jupiter favors us, our ships should reach the Cretan shore 3 days from now." Those were his words. Then he made due sacrifice at the altars. For Neptune, a bull, and a bull for you, beauteous Apollo. A black lamb to the storm god, a white to the genial Zephyrs. A report went round that King Idomeneus had been exiled from his ancestral realm, that the coast of Crete and its dwellings, being emptied of our foe, we'd find homes ready and waiting. So we left the port of Delos, and skimming the deep we coasted Naxos, the hilly haunt of Bacchantes, and green Donysa, Olieros, and marble-white Peros, the Cyclades dotted over the sea, through straits that blossomed with many an island. The bosuns are calling the stroke, the oarsmen straining in rivalry. Crews shout one to another, "Roll on, Crete and our homeland!" A following breeze gets up, giving us speedy passage, until at last we glide to the ancient shores of Crete. Eagerly setting to work on the walls of my chosen city, I name it Pergamea. I encourage my folk, who delight in that name, to love it as home and make the town centre imposing. Our ships had not been beached long. Our men were just engaged in breaking the soil and taking wives, while I was busy on laws and housing, when a blight spread over the sky. A wasting epidemic attacked our bodies. There fell on trees and crops a hideous plague, a season of death. Some gave up the ghost, some dragged out life in sickness. The dog days seared the fields with a heat wave till they were barren. Grass died of thirst, the diseased crops denied us nourishment. My father now advised we should sail back again to the Oracle of Delos, that the god might graciously tell us what end was assigned to these crippling mischances, where we should look to for help out of our troubles, and whither should steer our course. It was night, and sleep enfolded all denizens of earth. The sacred images of the gods, the Trojan home gods which I had carried with me from out the blazing heart of Troy, as I lay asleep now, their presences appeared before my eyes, revealed in a fullness of light, where the full moon's radiance was flooding through the windows of my room. They spoke to me, and their words relieved my anxious heart. "That which Apollo would say if you went up to Delos, he utters here. I, look, he sends us to you of his own grace. We, when Ilium burned, followed you and your cause. We went with you on shipboard over the surging sea. Even so shall we exalt your seed to heaven, and make their city an empress. Do you seek out a great place for great ones, and never give up, though long and hard your exile. You must change homes. This is not the land which Delian Apollo oracled for you. It was not in Crete he bade you settle. There is a place, the Greeks call it Hesperia, an antique land, well warded, possessed of a rich soil. Oenotrians colonized it, whose heirs, so rumor says now, have named it after their first founder, Italy. There is our real home. There was Dardanus born, and old Iasius. There did our line begin. Rise up, then, With a cheerful mind, repeat to your father these sure and certain sayings. Let Corythus be his bourn and Italy, for Jove forbids you to colonize Crete. I was amazed by that vision and voice of the deities. This was not sleep. I seemed to recognize in the room there the aspect, the garlanded hair, the very face of my home gods, and a cold sweat was trickling over my body then. I was out of bed in a moment, lifting the palms of my hands to heaven, putting up a prayer, pouring upon the hearth a libation of wine unwatered. When the rite was done, I felt better, and told Anchises exactly what I had experienced. He saw that he'd confused two branches of our family and made a novel mistake in the old topographical law. Now he is saying, "My son, much wrought by the doom of Ilium, you must know that Cassandra alone prophesied me such happenings. I recollect now her predicting these things as our people's destiny. Hesperia and Italy were often upon her tongue. But who could have thought that Trojans would ever come to the shores of Hesperia? Whom could Cassandra's presages influence then? Let us bow to Apollo's warnings and take the better way." He spoke. We agreed with his words. All were enthusiastic. So this place too we abandoned, leaving a few behind us, and spreading sail, we drove our hulls through the vasty sea. When we were well away in deep water, out of sight now of land, with nothing but sea and sky wherever we looked, an indigo-coloured rain cloud stood overhead, the precursor of gloom and storm, and the sea's face darkened with shuddering cat's paws. Winds billowed the sea at once, the seas were running high, and we were hurled in a tossing waste, all contact gone. Rainstorms muffled the daylight, a streaming night inked out the sky, flash upon flash of lightning shattered the clouds. Thrown off our course, we blindly groped about on the waters. Palinurus himself, our steersman, could not tell day from night, confessed he had lost his way in the wilderness of water. 3 days, 3 days, befogged and unsighted by that darkness, we wandered upon the sea. 3 starless nights we wandered. At last, on the 4th day, we sighted land in the offing, a view of faraway mountains and smoke spiralling up. We struck our sails, we strained at the oars. Our mariners quickly made the foam fly with their hard stroke, sweeping the dark blue sea. It was the coast of the Strophades, which rose to welcome me, preserved from the waves. Strophades being the Greek name for those islands in the broad Ionian Sea where dreadful Celino and her coven of harpies dwell. Now the house of Phineus is barred, and in fear they have left their pristine banquets. No viler monstrosity than they. No pest more atrocious did ever the wrath of God conjure up out of hell's swamp. Bird-bodied, girl-faced things they are. Abominable their droppings. Their hands are talons. Their faces haggard with hunger, insatiable. When we had made our landfall and entered port, we observed abundant herds of cattle dotted over the vale, and goat flocks browsing there without any goat herd by them. We slaughtered some. We invited Jove and the other gods to take their share of the spoil. Then, by the winding shore, seated on makeshift benches, we are most richly feasting. But, the next moment, we hear a hoarse vibration of wing beats. The harpies are on us, horribly swooping down from the mountains. They tear the banquet to pieces, filthying all with their bestial touch. Hideous the sounds, nauseous the stench about us. We choose a secluded spot under an overhanging crag, enclosed by trees and their shifting shadows, to set up our tables again and light a fire on a new altar. Again from their hidden lairs, flying in from different angles, that noisy coven claws at the feast, hovering around it, their mouths tainting the meat. So then, I order my friends, stand to arms, for we must fight this damnable brood. They did as they were ordered. They hid their swords in the grass, ready to hand, and put their shields out of sight beside them. So, when the creatures again came screeching round the bay, Maecenas, from an observation post above us, blew the alarum. My friends went into an unfamiliar combat, trying their steel on sinister birds of the sea. But blows did not make them turn a feather. Their bodies would not be wounded. They simply flew off at high speed into the blue, leaving a half-devoured feast and their own disgusting traces. Celino alone, perching upon a rock pinnacle, stayed behind and broke into speech, a fortune-teller of evil.
"So, you're willing to go to war? To war, sons of Laomedon, over the cattle you slaughtered, over slain bullocks? Prepared to drive us innocent harpies out of our rightful domain? Very well. Take these words to heart and never forget them. What the Father Almighty foreshowed to Phoebus Apollo and he to me, will I, the chief of the Furies, reveal you. You are making all speed for Italy, and the winds won over, to Italy you shall go, even enter port you may, but before you can wall your promised city, outrageous famine shall fasten upon you in return for trying to kill us, and force you to chew your tables, yes, gnaw at them, and devour them."
She spoke. She winged away into the sheltering forest. As for my friends, their blood went cold with the shock of panic and curdled. Their hearts sank. "No more fighting," they said. "Through vows and prayers alone we must seek security, whether those creatures are of heaven or uncanny birds of ill omen." Anchises stretched out his hands from the shore in supplication to the powers above, appointing due sacrifice in their honour.
"Ye gods, prevent these threats. Ye gods, avert this calamity. Incline your hearts to the faithful. O, save us!"
Then he gave orders to cast off the moorings, to free the sheets and pay them out. A south wind filled the sails. We flew before it over the white-capped waves whither the breeze and our helmsman took us. Presently hove in sight the sea-girt woody Zakynthos, Dulichium, and Same, and the sheer cliffs of Neritos. We ran past the promontories of Ithaca, Laertes' kingdom, cursing the land that bred cruel Ulysses. Later we opened the cloudy peaks of Mount Leucata, then the Temple of Apollo, a warning landmark to mariners. Here we put in, exhausted, near to the little town. Bow anchors were thrown out. The ships were beached by the stern. So, at last, hoping against hope, we'd come to land. We performed purification rites to Jove. We made burnt offerings, and on the shores of Actium we held the Trojan Games. Stripping and oiling their bodies, my comrades practiced our old traditional wrestling bouts. Light-hearted they were to have won past so many Greek cities, made good their escape through the enemy. The sun went rolling on through the circuit of a whole year. Freezing winter roughened the sea with northerly gales. A rounded shield of bronze, borne once by the warrior Abbas, I nailed to a door, and wrote this line in dedication. "These arms, Aeneas, from the victorious Danae." Then I gave orders to man the ships and clear from harbour. Eagerly rowed my comrades, sweeping the sea with long strokes. Soon were the lofty peaks of Corcyra lost to view. We coasted along Epirus, and coming to the Chaonian harbour, we drew near Buthrotum, that hill city. Here we heard a rumour of quite extraordinary doings, that Helenus, son of Priam, was king over Greek cities, having acquired Pyrrhus' scepter and wife, Andromache, who thus had passed again to a man of her own people. I was astonished. I felt a wonderful strong desire to talk with Helenus and learn how it all happened. I set forth from the harbour, leaving our fleet on the shore. Just then, as it chanced, in a grove near the city, where flowed a make-believe Simois, was Andromache, performing the sad and solemn rites of the dead, with wine for the ashes and invocations to the spirit, at Hector's cenotaph, an empty mound of green turf, and twin altars the widow had consecrated to grief. When she caught sight of me coming, and saw the Trojan accoutrements, she was frightened out of her wits by the marvel of it, Her body went rigid as she gazed, and the warmth ebbed from her bones. She fainted. After a long while, she just managed to speak.
"Are you real? This shape I see? Can you really bring me news, O goddess born? Are you living? Or if your day is done, tell me, where's Hector?"
With these words, she burst into tears. One could hear only her sobs. I can hardly get in a brief answer, she's so upset. My own voice is broken and incoherent with feeling.
"I'm alive, to be sure. Living on through every kind of adversity. Doubt not that what you see is real. But, oh, how have you fared since of so great a husband you were deprived? What fortune, worthy of Hector's Andromache, has smiled on you? Or are you still united to Pyrrhus?"
With eyes downcast, and speaking in a low voice, she said,
"Oh, luckiest of us all, that maiden daughter of Priam who was appointed to die on an enemy's tomb beneath the walls of Troy, the one whom no man drew lots for, the one who never knew captivity or the bed of a conqueror. But I, when our home lay in ashes, was carried off overseas, endured the contemptuous treatment of Achilles' insolent son, and bore his children in slavery. Afterwards, when he wanted a Greek wife, Leda's Hermione, he passed me on to Helenus, and made me the slave wife of a slave. But Orestes, then, consumed with violent love for his stolen bride, and driven mad by the Furies which punish crime, took Pyrrhus off guard and murdered him at his father's altar, on whose decease a part of his kingdom was restored to Helenus, who christened these the Chaonian Plains, named the whole of the country after Chaon of Troy, and rebuilt Troy's very keep upon our foothills here. But you, what made you come? Was it weather or providence brought you? Which of the gods impelled you towards this land you knew not? What of your boy, Ascanius? Is he still in the land of the living? He was your son in the old days at Troy. Does he still think about the mother whom he lost? Does the example of Aeneas and his uncle Hector awaken him the old-time virtues, the hero spirit?"
The words poured out. She was weeping, a long-drawn fit of fruitless weeping, when from the city, with a great retinue round him, approached the son of Priam, the hero, Helenus. He recognized his kin, and took us back to the palace, talking to us, interspersing his words with tears of happiness. As we went, I saw the town was a miniature Troy, a model of mighty Pergamum, saw a dry watercourse named for Xanthus, and a Scaean gate whose threshold I kissed. My Trojans enjoyed with me the city's hospitality. The king was entertaining them in his great hall surrounded by colonnades. They were drinking from cups of wine, each man goblet in hand, with a feast on golden plates before them. One day passed, and another, and now the breezes wooed our sails impatiently, and the canvas swelled in a south wind. So then I approached the seer, making request of him. "Scion of Troy, and heaven's mouthpiece, you that vibrate to Apollo's presence, the tripod, the laurels, you the diviner of what the stars portend and the songs and flights of birds, oh tell me, since I have had divine sanction for all my journey, and all the gods have expressed their will that I should make for Italy, should try for that faraway land. Only the harpy, Celino, prophesies an uncanny new horror, threatening us with malevolent wrath and a gruesome famine. Tell me what dangers I am first to avoid, or in what way I can overcome these numerous troubles." Helenus sacrificed some bullocks, as is the custom, beseeching heavenly grace, unbound the headdress from his reverend head, and took me by the hand into Apollo's temple. How awed I was by the sense of imminent deity! Then was the priestly king inspired to utter these words: "Goddess born, it is beyond question true that your voyage has higher sanction. The Father of Heaven predestines it, and spinning the wheel of chance, ordains for you such fortunes. Therefore, that you may safelier travel the unfamiliar seas and winning to port establish yourself in Italy, a few things out of many will I reveal. The fates deny me further knowledge, and Juno forbids me to say more. First, then, the Italy you imagine so close, that you're ready mistakenly to enter her ports any day now, in fact is a very long way from here, and the way is far from easy. You will have to strain at the oars in the Sicilian waters, voyage the whole length of the Ausonian Sea, and pass the infernal lakes and the Tyrrhene island of Circe, before you can establish your town in a land safe for you. These signs will I declare you. Store them up in your memory. When, anxious of heart, you shall come to a lonely river and find there, under the ilex trees lining its bank, a sow, a great white sow, with a litter of 30 newborn piglets, white as she, clustered at the teats of their sprawling mother. There is the site for your city, the terminus of your travails. And do not let the threat about biting the tables intimidate you. Fate will find out a way. Apollo will come to your call. What you must shun is that part of Italy yonder, the coast nearest to ours and washed by the tides of our own sea. For ill-disposed Greeks are settled in all the townships there. In one place the Nerissian Locri have built battlements, and Lictian Idomeneus has garrisoned the plains of the Salentines. Elsewhere you'll find little Petilia squat on its walls, the town of the Melibean chief Philoctetes. Another thing. When your ships have crossed the seas and are anchored, when you perform your vows at the altar set up ashore, remember to veil your head with a purple covering, lest, as you worship the gods amid the altar fires, some enemy visage should meet your gaze and turn the omens awry. This ceremonial you and your friends must always adhere to. By this observance your heirs may stand firm in the faith. Now when you have left that first landfall and sail to Sicily, at the point where Pelorus begins to reveal a narrow opening, steer for the land on your port bow, the seas to port, and make a detour giving a wide berth to shore and breakers a starboard. Once on a time, they say, these two lands were a single country. Then there came a convulsion of nature which tore them hugely asunder. The ages can bring such immense geological change. And the sea rushed violently in between them, dividing Italy from Sicily, severing their coasts and washing cities and fields on either side with a narrow strait. Scylla guards the right shore, insatiable Charybdis the left. 3 times a day the latter, down in the depths of a whirlpool, gulps whole tons of wave into her maw, then spews them up again, flailing the heavens with spray. But Scylla lurks unseen in a cavernous lair, from which she pushes out her lips to drag ships onto the rocks. Her upper part is human, a girl's beautiful body down to the privates. Below, she is a weird sea monster, with dolphin's tail and a belly of wolverine sort. It's advisable to fetch a long compass, although it protracts the voyage, and sail right round the Sicilian Cape of Pachynum, a southernmost mark, rather than to set eyes on that freakish Scylla within her cavern vast, or the rocks where her sea-blue hounds are baying. Finally, if I have any foresight, if you can trust my divinings at all, if Apollo inspires my soul to truth, this one thing, Aeneas, I solemnly tell you. One thing which sums up all, and I cannot repeat the warning too often. It's paramount that Juno should have your prayers and homage. Be zealous in making your vows to Juno, and wooing her powerful partisanship with a suppliant's gifts. Do this, and at last you will obtain a fair passage from Sicily to Italy. Now when you are safely there, close to the city of Cumae and the haunted lake Avernus, deep in a sowing wood, you will find an ecstatic, a seeress, who in her anter communicates destiny, committing to leaves the mystic messages. Whatever runes that virgin has written upon the leaves, she files away in her cave, arranged in the right order. There they remain, untouched, just as she put them away. But suppose that the hinge turns, and a light draught blows through the door, stirs the frail leaves and shuffles them. Never thereafter cares she to catch them, as they flutter about the cave, to restore their positions or reassemble the runes. So, men who have come to consult the Sibyl depart no wiser, hating the place. Here, you must not grudge time spent, although it delays you. However impatient your friends may grow, however fine the weather for sailing, however strongly the sea calls you, time spent in approaching the Sibyl, asking an oracle of her, praying that she will graciously open her mouth and prophesy. Then will she tell you of wars to come with the tribes of Italy, how to evade or endure each crisis upon your way. And if you pay reverence to her, she will give you a favourable passage. Such are the counsels I am permitted to offer you. Go your way, then, exalting great Troy with famous deeds.
After the prophet had spoken thus in friendly wise, he gave instructions for presents to be carried down to the ships, presents of solid gold, objects inlaid with ivory. He cargoed us with silver and cauldrons from Dodona, a cuirass made of golden chainmail, triple meshed, and a helmet fine with plumes on its tapering crest, which had once belonged to Pyrrhus. Besides, there were personal gifts for my father. He furnished as well horses and guides, brought crews up to strength, and fully equipped my friends. Now was Anchises urgent for the sails of our fleet to be rigged, so that a favouring wind should find us not unready. Whereupon the prophet of Phoebus respectfully addressed him. Anchises, once thought worthy of divine marriage by Venus, close to the heart of the gods, twice saved from Troy's destruction, look yonder! There is Italy! Make sail for that land with all speed. Yet it is written that you shall drift past yonder shore. Far is the region of Italy revealed for you by Apollo. Fare forth, Anchises, blessed in the love of your son. The winds are rising. No more words from me, no more delaying. Andromache, too, saddened by this long-last farewell, brings Ascanius presents, a robe patterned with gold thread and an embroidered cloak. She is not backward in courtesy, but loads him with the work of her loom, and says to him, "Take these things, too, dear lad, as keepsakes to remind you of her who made them, tokens of the abiding love of Andromache, Hector's wife. Yes, take these gifts from your kin, these last gifts. You are the image of my son, Astyanax, in eyes and hands and mien the picture of him, the one picture left me. He would have been your age now, like you, growing to manhood." Tears came to my eyes as I spoke these parting words. "Long may you live and lucky, you who have now accomplished your destiny. We are banded from one vicissitude to another. For you, no ploughing the prairies of sea, no endless chasing after the ever-receding fields of Italy. Peace for you is born. You behold a Xanthus in replica, a Troy your hands have built, under better omens, I pray, than the old Troy, and further out of the way of the Greeks. If ever I get to Tiber, and the lands adjacent to Tiber, if ever I set eyes on the place marked out for my people, one day from those sister cities, those neighbouring tribes in Epirus and in Hesperia, which share the same ancestor, Dardanus, and the same tale of disaster, we'll make one single-hearted Troy. Let that be a charge we leave to our posterity." Forth we went on the sea, the Ceraunian cliffs being close in the offing, for that course gave the shortest passage to Italy. Now the sun went down, and the mountains were veiled in shadow. Putting ashore, we shipped the oars, then gratefully sinking down on the bosom of earth, we lay scattered about on the dry beach, restoring our strength, while sleep flowed over our spent bodies. Night, driven on by the hours, was not yet in mid-career, when Palinurus alertly rose from his bed and tested the weather, pricking his ears for any breath of a breeze. All the stars he scanned as they slid through the quiet sky, Arcturus and the rainy Hyades and the twin bears. Orion he observed with its golden sword and sword belt. Noting that all was set fair in the calm sky, he blew a clear trumpet call from the poop. We left that bivouac, and spreading the sail's pinions went forth upon our way. And now, the stars dispersed by the first flush of dawn, we sighted, far away, dim hills and a low coastline, Italy. Achates was the first to hail, "Italy! Italy!" my comrades echoed in cheerful greeting. Then did my father, Anchises, garland a mighty bowl and fill it with wine, and taking his stand high up on the stern above us, invoked the gods. "You deities who control the sea, the earth and the weather, grant us fair winds and an easy passage. Breathe kindly upon us." A freshening breeze answered his prayer. Getting nearer, we opened a harbour mouth, and saw, on Minerva's height, a temple. Furling the sails, my comrades changed course direct for the land. That harbour was hollowed out by the action of heavy seas in east winds. At its entrance are reefs that smoke in a smother of spray, concealing the harbour. Turreted cliffs slope down two arms to form its walls, and the temple lies back from the foreshore. Here, an initial omen, I espied four horses freely grazing the deep-grassed vale, four horses white as snow. Then pronounced Anchises, "War is your word, O strange land, for war are horses needed. And those steeds there mean war. Nevertheless, in time can these same cattle be trained for the shafts, and learn to bear in amity yoke and bridle. So there are hopes for peace, too." Then we prayed to the power divine of Athene, the clasher of arms, who received our first thanksgiving, veiling our heads at the altar with wraps of embroidered stuff, and following the instructions which Helenus had most emphasized, duly offered to Argive Juno a burnt sacrifice. At once, as soon as our vows had been properly performed, trimming our yards to the wind, under a press of canvas we left that abode of Greeks, that unreassuring district. Next we raised the Gulf of Tarentum, Hercules' town, if the legend is true, and opposite the temple of the Licinian goddess, Colonia's heights and shipwrecking Cilicium. Then we made out Trinacrian Etna on the horizon, and from afar we heard a thunder of waves throbbing on rocks, and inshore noises broke fitfully on our ears. The race was dancing with fury, the shoal water boiling with sand. Anchises cried, "That must be the infamous Charybdis! Those are the reefs, the terrible rocks that Helenus told of! Row for your lives, my comrades! Pull together! Pull!" Yearly they all obeyed my father's command. Palinurus turned away first to port, the bows of his vessel creaking. Then the whole convoy, with oars and sails, clawed off to port. We were tossed up high on an arching surge, then down we went, in the trough, as the wave fell away, down to the very pit. Thrice roared aloud the reefs and the caverns of rock beneath us. Thrice we beheld the sky through a spattering flounce of spindrift. Time passed. The wind went down with the sun. Utterly spent, not knowing where we were, we crept to the shores of the Cyclops. There lies a haven, sheltered from all four winds. It is calm and roomy, too. But nearby, Etna thunderously erupts. Ever and anon it discharges at heaven a murky cloud, a swirl of pitch-black smoke lurid with white-hot cinders, and volleys huge balls of flame singeing the very stars. Ever and anon, as if the mountain's guts were being coughed up, it belches rock and, groaning, vomits out thick streams of lava seething up from its roots. The story goes that Enceladus, charred by Jove's lightning, is crushed beneath this mountain mass, that Etna was dumped down bodily on him, and like a leaky furnace jets out the fire which consumes him. So, every time he turns over to rest one aching side, Sicily quakes and rumbles, smoke hangs above like an awning. That night, we hid in the woods, enduring these gigantic phenomena, and unable to see what caused the din. For the lights of the stars were out. There was no shine on the face of heaven from the constellations, only a fog which bandaged its eyes, and clouds which muffled the moon at this dead of night. And now, tomorrow was here, with the first star of the morning, and sunrise had uncurtained the dark, dew-dropping sky, when suddenly there stepped out of the woods a strange individual, a man unknown to us, in rags and a state of extreme emaciation, who stretched imploring hands to us on the shore. We looked round, appallingly dirty, his beard overgrown, his rags held together with thorns. In all else, he was a Greek, a man who had gone to Troy once in the Greek expeditionary force. He, when from a distance he saw our Trojan dress and equipment, stood stock still for a little, scared at the sight, unable to move. But soon he was frantically running down to the beach, sobbing out entreaties.
"By the heavens above, Trojans, by the gods in heaven, by the breath and light of life, I beseech you, rescue me. Get me away, to whatever land, I care not, that's all I ask. I know I was one of the Greek invaders. I own that I helped to make war against your Trojan homes. If you feel what I did was so dreadful a crime, then punish me. Tear me limb from limb and sink my remains in the broad sea. If I must die, at least I'll have died at the hands of humans."
He spoke. He clasped our knees and clung, writhing about them. So we encouraged him to tell us his name and his family, tell us what fate had brought him to this. My father, Anchises, after a brief hesitation, offered the man his hand, a gesture of immediate good faith to reassure him. He, at last throwing off his apprehensions, spoke out.
"I am of Ithaca, a comrade of luckless Ulysses, Achaemenides by name. My father, Adamastus, being poor, would that we'd stayed as we were, I went to Troy. Here, in the Cyclops' cave, my companions left me behind, forgetting me in their panicky haste to quit the ogre's domain. A house of blood and bloody feasts that cave is, gloomy within, immense. So tall is its master, he knocks his head on the stars. Ye gods, rid the earth of such cankers. He is not easy on the eye, not one you can cozily talk to. He fancies the flesh and dark blood of wretched human victims. I saw him myself seize two of our company with his huge hand, then, lolling back in the cave, smash their bodies against a rock, until the whole place was spattered and swimming with gore. And then I saw him munching my friend's blood-bolted bodies, saw the still warm limbs quivering under his teeth. Ulysses did not let the Cyclops go unpunished. Dire was the extremity, but Ulysses kept his head. For when, gorged on the meal and sodden with wine, the Cyclops bowed his neck, lay down, stretched himself the whole length of the cave, and was belching blood and human fragments mingled with bloody wine in his sleep, we, then, after praying the gods for strength and drawing by lot our places, hemmed the ogre round, bored into his eye with a sharp stake. That single, gigantic eye, deep set in his savage brow, that eye as huge as an Argive shield, or the sun itself. So, with fierce joy, we avenged our comrades in the end. But you must get out of here. Quick! Cut the cables, or else you'll rue it. That Polyphemus, folding his woolly flocks in the cave and milking them, he is not unique. There are 100 other Cyclops, as big and fierce as he, at large, over these winding shores and these high hills, the monsters. 3 times now have the horns of the moon filled up with light since I began to lead this life in the woods, among dens and uninhabited haunts of wild beasts, on crags looking out for the one-eyed giants, trembling at the sound of their voice and tread. A starveling diet of berries and stone-hard cornels was all the woods supplied, with roots of herbs I plucked to feed on. Though long, and everywhere I gazed, I saw no help till your ships hove in sight. To you, however it turned out, I committed myself. Anything to have escaped that brood of abomination. At your hands would any death be preferable. Scarce had he finished speaking when, moving down from the mountain towards the well-known shore, mammoth in bulk, his sheep flock round him, we saw that same shepherd, that Polyphemus, a monster, grisly, misshapen, titanic, his eye gone. He carries the trunk of a pine tree to guide and support him walking, the fleecy sheep go with him. They are his only pleasure and consolation in woe. When he had come to the sea's edge and touched the surging deep, he washed the socket of his eye, which oozed blood, with sea-water, gritting his teeth and groaning. Then waded into the deep sea. Yet even there the water did not come up to his waist. Frightened, we hurried to get far away, taking on board that Greek who so merited mercy, and stealthily cutting the cables. Frantically, we tugged at the oars, we swept the sea's face. He sensed us, veered his steps towards the noise of our passage. But when he found there was no way of laying his hands upon us, and he was falling behind in his race with the waves which carried us, then he let out a stupendous bellow, shivering the whole expanse of the sea, shaking Italy to its core with fright, and reverberating through Etna's and fractious caves. Whereupon the Cyclops people were roused. From hill and forest they ran down towards the roadstead and swarmed upon the beach. There they stood, the fraternity of Etna, impotent, with baleful eyes and their sky-scraping heads. We saw them, a terrifying assembly. So, on some mountain top, head-in-air oaks are massed, or cone-bearing cypresses, Jupiter's own tall wood, or a grove sacred to Diana. Our panic prompted us to pay out the sheets and run for it, whatever the course might be, scudding before the wind. Yet Helenus had warned not to attempt the passage between Scylla and Charybdis, there being on either side so narrow a margin of safety. Well, in the end we resolved to put about. But just then we caught a northerly wind, slanting from Cape Pelorus. So on we went past the rocks at Pantagias' mouth, the Megarian Bay, and low-lying Thapsus. Such places along the coast Achaemenides pointed out to us, retracing now the route he had come with unlucky Ulysses.
Over against wave-worn Plemirium, there's an island athwart the Gulf of Syracuse, an isle the ancients named Ortygia. According to legend, Alpheus, the river of Elis, once drove a secret passage hither, beneath the seabed, to mingle at Arethusa's fount with waters of Sicily. As instructed, we worship the patron spirits of the place. Then on, past the marshy mouth of Helorus with its most fertile soil. Next we skirt Pacinus, a place of high rocks and jutting reefs, and now, far off, is Camarina, which fate said must never be reclaimed, and the Geloan Plains, and Gela, which is named after its own wild river. Then Acragas on its crag shows from afar its great walls, a town renowned one time for its mettlesome breed of horses. The wind blows fair, and we leave palm-fringed Selinus behind to skirt Lilybaeum's waters, tricky with reefs submerged. After which we put in at Port Drepanum, a landfall of little joy, for here, after so many storms weathered, I lost, alas, my father, him who had lightened my cares and troubles. Lost Anchises. Oh, best of fathers, to leave me here, sick-hearted, when you had survived, yet all for nothing, such dangers. The seer Helenus, though many horrors he warned of, never predicted this grief, nor did the sinister Celino. This was the last agony, the turning point of my long course. From there, Providence took me and drove me upon your coasts. So, while all the others intently listened, Aeneas recounted his heaven-sent trials and told about his wanderings. Now he stops talking and falls silent. His story done. Book 4. But now, for some while, the queen had been growing more grievously lovesick, feeding the wound with her life-blood, the fire biting within her. Much did she muse on the hero's nobility, and much on his family's fame. His look, his words had gone to her heart and lodged there. She could get no peace from love's disquiet. The morrow's morn had chased from heaven the dewy darkness, was carrying the sun's torch far and wide over earth, when, almost beside herself, she spoke to her sister, her confidant.
"Anna, sister, why do these nerve-wracking dreams haunt me? This man, this stranger I've welcomed into my house, what of him? How gallantly he looks, how powerful in chest and shoulders. I really do think, and have reason to think, that he is heaven-born. Mean souls convict themselves by cowardice. Oh, imagine the fates that have harried him, the fight to a finish he told of. Were it not that my purpose is fixed irrevocably, never to tie myself in wedlock again to anyone, since that first love of mine proved false, and let death cheat me, had I not taken a loathing for the idea of marriage, for him, for this one man, I could perhaps have weakened. Anna, I will confess it, since poor Sychaeus, my husband, was killed and our home broken up by my brother's murderous act, this man is the only one who has stirred my senses and sapped my will. I feel once more the scars of the old flame. But no, I would rather the earth should open and swallow me, or the Father of Heaven strike me with lightning down to the shades, the pale shades and deep night of the underworld, before I violate or deny pure widowhood's claim upon me. He who first wedded me took with him, when he died, my right to love. Let him keep it there, in the tomb, forever.
So Dido spoke, and the rising tears flooded her bosom. Anna replied, "You are dearer to me than the light of day. Must you go on wasting your youth in mourning and solitude,
never to know the blessings of love, the delight of children? Do you think that ashes or ghosts underground can mind about such things? I know that in Libya, yes, and in Tyre before it, no wooers could touch your atrophied heart. Yabas was rejected, and other lords of Africa, the breeding ground of the great. Very well. But when love comes and pleases, why fight against it? Besides, you should think of the nations whose land you have settled in. Threatening encirclement are the Getuli, indomitable in war. The Numidians, no bridal for them. The unfriendly Sirtes. On your other frontier, a waterless desert and the far-raging Barsii. I need not mention the prospect of Tyrian aggression, your brother's menacing attitude. I hold it was providential indeed, and Juno willed it that hither the Trojan fleet should have made their way. Oh, sister, married to such a man, what a city you'll see! What a kingdom established here! With the Trojans as our comrades in arms, what heights of glory will not we Carthaginians soar to? Only solicit the gods' favour, perform the due rites, and plying our guest with attentions, spin a web to delay him, while out at sea the winter runs wild and Orion is stormy, while his ships are in bad repair, while the weather is unacquiescent. These words blew to a blaze the spark of love in the queen's heart, set hope to her wavering will, and melted her modesty's rigour. So first they went to the shrines, beseeching at every altar for grace. As religion requires, they sacrificed chosen sheep to Ceres, giver of increase, to Phoebus, and to the wine god, to Juno, chief of all, for the marriage bond is her business. Dido herself, most beautiful, chalice in hand, would pour libations between the horns of a milk-white heifer, and slowly would pace by the dripping altars, with the gods looking on, and daily renew her sacrifice, poring over the victims' opened bodies, to see what their pulsing entrails signified. Ah, little the soothsayers know. What value have vows or shrines for a woman wild with passion? The while love's flame eats into her gentle flesh, and love's wound works silently in her breast. So burns the ill-starred Dido, wandering at large through the town in a rage of desire, like a doe pierced by an arrow, a doe which some hunting shepherd has hit with a long shot while unwary she stepped through the Cretan woods, and all unknowing has left his winged weapon within her. The doe runs fleetly around the Dictaean woods and clearings, the deathly shaft stuck deep in her flank. Now she conducts Aeneas on a tour of her city, and shows him the vast resources of Carthage, the home there ready and waiting. Begins to speak, then breaks off, leaving a sentence unfinished. Now, as the day draws out, she wants to renew that first feast, in fond distraction begs to hear once again the Trojan story, and hangs on his words as once again he tells it. Then, when the company's broken up, when the moon is dimming her beams in turn, and the dipping stars invite to sleep, alone she frets in the lonely house, lies down on her bed, then leaves it again. He's not there, not there, but she hears him and sees him. Or, charmed by his likeness to his father, she keeps Ascanius long in her lap, to assuage the passion she must not utter. Work on the half-built towers is closed down meanwhile. The men of Carthage have laid off drilling, or building the wharves and vital defences of their town.
The unfinished works are idle. Great frowning walls, head-in-air cranes, all at a standstill. Now, as soon as Jupiter's consort perceived that Dido was mad with love and quite beyond caring about her reputation, she, Juno, approached Venus, making these overtures.
A praiseworthy feat, I must say. A fine achievement you've brought off, you and your boy. It should make a great, a lasting name for you. One woman mastered by the arts of two immortals. It has not entirely escaped me that